I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. If you're thinking about it, chances are we're talking about it on WHYY's Radio Times.
Support for this public radio podcast comes from A.G. Edwards, caring for nest eggs for more than 120 years with a commitment to provide objective financial advice.
Radio Times. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Alice Siebold knows how to grab the attention of her readers. Here's how her memoir, Lucky, begins. In the tunnel where I was raped, a tunnel that was once an underground entry to an amphitheater, a place where actors birthed forth from underneath the seats of a crowd, a girl had been murdered and dismembered. Here's how she begins her best-selling first novel, The Lovely Bones. My name is Salmon, like the fish, first name Susie. I was 14 when I was murdered on December 6, 1973. And here's the first sentence from her much-anticipated new novel called The Almost Moon. When all is said and done, killing my mother came easily. The story is about Helen Knightley, the divorced mother of two grown children who's been taking care of her bitter, abusive, and mentally ill mother, a woman named Claire. It's about the intense bond between a mother and a daughter, about how dementia and dysfunction plays out in a family, and in spite of the subject matter, it also has moments of dark humor. Alice Siebold grew up in the suburbs of Philadelphia and joins us this morning on Radio Times, and nice to have you back on the show.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
You have a reputation as a novelist who writes shocking, surprising first sentences. I don't know if that's fair, not fair. Do you like that? Do you not like that?
I don't mind it. It's not the worst thing in the world to have a reputation for.
And do you labor over that first sentence? I mean, is there something about that first sentence that you want a reader to read?
I think my first sentences might be the way they are because it takes me so long to find the voice to tell the story in. So by the time the reader reads the actual first sentence, it's definitely not the first sentence that I ended up writing. So I've thought a lot before I get to that final sentence for me, which is the first sentence for the reader.
But you obviously have to understand this character, and as you say, sort of understand, I guess, what her voice is.
Exactly.
Because I would say in your first novel and in this novel, it's a very strong and distinctive voice for these two different characters.
Definitely. I mean, for me, at least so far, the subjects that I've written about are challenging enough that I feel like I've needed a character that's tough and strong and resilient, and so I've searched to create that voice that was tough enough, strong mm-hmm. enough, and resilient enough to bear, the burdens of the story that I wanted to tell. And it takes a while to find that
sure.
voice.
Do you, with a novel like this, was there an incident or something that you read or something that you thought about that got you into this story or even got you to think about this character, Helen?
I think for me, it's, lifelong obsessions kind of come together, and in some sense they are the weather that people live in. They're the individual's atmosphere. It's not that you consciously read a news story and decide, oh, I'm going to write a book about that. Little things may continually remind you of mm-hmm. certain conditions, and I watched my mother care for her mother. That was certainly a significant experience for me. I feel like I'm very affected by what I consider the romantic way we have of looking at mothers and daughters and children in general. I'm also very compelled by the fact that the elderly are getting older, and mm-hmm. now the elderly are actually taking care of the elderly. Elderly daughters are taking care of elderly mothers, and that's putting a huge burden on those daughters. And also, I keep using the word daughters because there is still the societal expectation that it is the daughter
exactly.
who is the caretaker. There's all that, and then you throw, a bunch of other stuff into the mix, and
voila.
Yeah, exactly. So
there's your novel.
Yeah, it's
right?
kind of like cooking, I guess.
Well, I'm glad you raised that both, I guess, an image and a story about mothers taking care of their, or daughters taking care of their mothers, because I've certainly watched that in my family. I've watched that in friends' family. And it's, for some, it's a real, frankly, liberation once that mother has died. And it's not as if you wish them dead, although we'll get to that in the story, but just how that daughter's life can be changed when that mother is no longer there.
Yeah, I do think, you know, the word freedom is not too strong a word to use, that there is that initial freedom that gets paired, obviously, with grief. But in a long caretaking, the grieving is going on as the person is still alive. And, you know, the weight of the caretaking just increases, increases, and increases. And so at the death, you know, freedom rushes in this intense way that also brings in a lot of guilt.
Because why should I feel this way?
Right. Why do I feel free? My mother, my father, whatever, has died.
Yeah. You mentioned the fact that you watched your mother care for her mother.
Mm-hmm.
Were there certain things about that caretaking that you noticed?
Just how exhausting it all was. And, you know, she would drive repeatedly for hours at a time to take my mother to, or my grandmother to every different medical appointment. And, you know, my mother was, I think, extremely loving. She was an only child, and it just was a very difficult and increasing burden mm-hmm. on a sole child. Just very hard to watch.
And when her mother died, what was the effect then on your mother?
I think she felt a little bit of freedom, but a lot of guilt.
As you were saying before, sort of freedom laced with guilt.
Yeah, I think it's impossible not to have those two things go hand in hand. And of course, you know, I tried to emphasize, you know, feel the freedom. But, you know, I think that may have only made her feel the guilt,
You can't win, can you? Well, tell us a little bit about this character, Helen Knightley. Then I'd love to have you read, actually, a section from the book. How do you even imagine her? What does she look like?
I wouldn't do that.
That's for the reader, right?
Yeah, that's for a reader, okay. Yeah.
Well, what is she like to you? I mean...
Well, I love Helen the way I loved Susie, and I think that that's kind of a necessary thing for a novelist. And when I say love, I don't mean in a kind of gushy, treacly way. I mean in a... I have deep respect for her as a person and for her, you know, the difficult position that she finds herself in, and for her intelligence and for her pluck, I guess, is what I would say. And her desire to battle a certain trap situation with, you know, her humor. So, you know, I when I say I love my characters, I would say that love is this. I of course also love them because they went with me through a book and actually carried my narrative. So,
and writers talk about that, about characters doing that job for them. Well, I'd love to have you read actually a section from the book.
Okay. I knelt down in front of her and looked up into her face. I hated her more than I'd hated anyone. Still, I reached up as if I were finally allowed to touch a precious thing and ran my fingers down my mother's long silver braid. "Mom," I whispered. I said it because I knew it would be still in the air. No reverberations, no response. But the wetness was making her unhappy. Like a snail trapped in sunlight, say, anxious to get away from an element that caused pain. I went from kneeling to half-bending over. I placed my shoulders against her shoulders, careful not to put any weight on her. I leaned in like a football player on a tackle, and then lifted up. She was both lighter and heavier than I'd expected. I got her to standing with ease, but once she was upright, she collapsed in my arms. It was all I could do not to drop her, bringing both of us to the ground. As I adapted to the balance of holding her full weight, I could not help but think of my father, how year after year he carried the burden of her, apologized to the neighbors, dried her copious tears, and how this body had folded into his over and over again, like so much batter, until the two of them became one. I felt like weeping myself then. We were near the end of us and the secrets of the house. I was 49 and my mother was 88. My father had been dead for almost the entire lifetime of my younger child, a few months after she'd turned 4. Sarah could never know the full measure of his sweetness or play in the workshop among his thrice-glued carpentry. I thought of the mutant rocking horses rotting in the shed, and my arms, with my mother in them, weakened dangerously. How the house and my life had changed after his death.
And that's Alice Siebold reading from her new novel, and it's called The Almost Moon. This mother that you created, this Claire, how do I say this, is a horrible person. Did you mean her to be? Did you want to create? I mean, she, and by that I mean she's selfish. She's mean. She is abusive. Mm. She says terrible things to her daughter. A pretty unlovable person.
All right. I think I wanted her to be complicated. And she is definitely, she is difficult. She's not meant to be what I think has become kind of the stereotypical sweet old lady. That is, again, another thing that, you know, not just I am sick of seeing, but I think a lot of old ladies are sick of seeing, too.
That they're, like, feistier and more complicated.
Yeah, and, you know, not all of them are unpleasant. You know, it's not as if they're just, you know, either really sweet and cookie-baking or, as Claire is, certainly, a prickly and unpleasant sort. But, you know, that there's a range of character for people who are over age 60, and certainly Claire fits into that, and she is. She's difficult, and she is unpleasant to the one person close to her and the one person she's most dependent on, who is her daughter.
And as the first sentence of this novel begins, when all is said and done, killing my mother came easily. I mean, this is something, as we learn about Helen's life, she really had thought about her whole life. I mean, but I do think that daughters do fantasize about that growing up. You're so angry at your mother.
Yeah,
you want to kill her.
I'm glad you said it, just because so many people won't say it, which is it's an honest part of the intense love and hate that you feel for a parent. And I think particularly with a mother-daughter bond, which is, you know, the only one that I can really speak to, which is you feel every range. You feel the intensity of love that you can't feel for almost anyone else in your life, and certainly not that kind of love. And you also feel the intensity of hate as well. What I did with this character was I made her go one step over that line and actually enact something that, you know, many of us would never do. But then the idea of, like, well, if you actually do enact that, what happens? What's the fallout? Where does that bring you mentally and emotionally? Where does that quote-unquote freedom, which of course isn't really freedom, lead you?
We're almost up on a break here, but do you feel like that was breaking a taboo? I mean, to go over that line, as you say, and make the fantasy a reality?
I never think in that way, but, you know, ultimately from some of the responses I've gotten, I guess so.
I would say so. I'll tell you what, let's take a very short break and then we'll get back to our conversation. That's Alice Siebold, our guest today on Radio Time. She's written a memoir and two novels. You probably read her first one. I think everyone did read her first one, called The Lovely Bones. And she's got a new novel out, much anticipated new novel out, and it's called The Almost Moon. Lines open at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Stay with us. Call us. We'll be right back.
Support for WHYY is provided by Freelancers Union at Working Today, providing health insurance, dental insurance, professional networking, and more to freelancers in a variety of industries. More at freelancersunion.org.
Widener University supports WHYY. Widener has graduate programs in education, social work, business, engineering, and more. Widener is hosting a graduate open house on Thursday, October 18th on the main campus in Chester. To register, 1-888-WIDENER or widener.edu. Other programs available in nursing, physical therapy, hospitality management, and more. 1-888-WIDENER or online at widener.edu.
Just a few days left for the fall membership campaign here at 91 FM. Have you made your pledge yet? Well, why not make it right now at 1-888-345-9499 or pledge online at whyy.org. The money that you invest in public radio here in the Delaware Valley comes back to you in the programs that you're listening to right now, like Radio Times. So make a call at 1-888-345-9499. You know where that money goes, or online at whyy.org. Thanks.
Support for WHYY is provided by Citibank, proud to join the neighborhood with 21 new branches in the Philadelphia area and on the web at www.citibank.com. Citibank, let's get it done.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss Cohen, and if you're just joining us, Alice Siebold is our guest today on the show, and we're talking about her new book. It's a novel, and it's called The Almost Moon. I wonder if you could explain the title of this book, and I ask that because there's a scene in the book where Helen Knightley's father explains something about her mother.
Helen is a child, and she and her father, it's at the end of a long and difficult day, family-wise, and they're standing outside. For the first time, Helen asks her father, basically, is there something wrong with my mother?
Right.
Her father tries to explain that some people are almost not quite, you know, that not everyone is whole, and that's his way of, he doesn't fully explain it, and the moon happens to be there, and so she says, like the moon, and so it works to create that image of the fact that the moon is always present, and that's the, much like a mother, you know, whether it's full or whether it's absent from the sky, you know, and just in blackness, it's actually always there. And it shapes your life. It you know, the whoever your mother is, even if you never knew her, the absence of your mother follows you.
And in this case, it's not exactly absence, but her mother has mental illness. I mean, that sounds so clinical, but would that be an apt description? I mean, it's something that people don't talk about in the novel, but it's clear she has some mental problems.
She has some mental problems, and I think it was for the purpose of the novel and for the kind of what I wanted to get at. I thought it was very important not to get into a diagnostic
exactly
situation. I think that there are many families with one member of the family who has some kind of emotional issue, and that ends up dominating the dynamics of the family in this big way. But it's not something that is, you know, a huge headline-grabbing mental illness. I also think doing that when you begin to name is a way for all of us to distance ourselves from those people. And I'm always hate that.
Sure. No, I understand that. Yeah. And it breaks the spell of the novel as well. And thinking of my sort of extended family, and I think it's probably true with all families, that there is mental illness, to use that very clinical word, people who just, you know, struggle with living in the world.
Right.
And trying to function within the world.
Exactly.
Was that true in your family?
There was some of that, and I also just think, don't we all struggle living in the world there?
Well,
that's my
course,
way of just
of course. of avoiding my question.
Yes, exactly. Subtle, aren't I?
You don't want to go there, so to speak?
You know, yes, there were issues in my family.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Because, again, in this novel, when things are not named in any kind of way, kids know when something is going on or something isn't right, and that's certainly true with Helen as a little girl. She watches her parents, especially her mother, so carefully, tries to explain things that seem so strange and odd.
Right. Well, I think sometimes what's interesting about, children, if they have a family member who's slightly unstable in any ways, they learn to be a caretaker, you know, almost upon birth, because they are always kind of watching and waiting and feeling very protective. You know, you grow up feeling that very protective sense for the parent. And also your love kind of increases with that protection. So
Helen talks about families as the kind of us and them. And I think, frankly, all families, you know, think that there's us. And we know how wacky we are. And then there's right. them. Everyone looks a little better from the outside
right.
looking in.
That's true, although I think some of the families I grew up with, their us was kind of like, we're going to beat you in badminton.
Oh,
it was a healthier us versus them.
Oh, I need to understand that a little bit better. Go ahead, Alice Ewald.
Well, just the kind of like, you know, that sports team kind of hiking,
gotcha.
You know, versus... you know, kind of the world is coming in and it's a brutal force right. and we must fight against it kind of mentality.
So sports as a kind of cover over of maybe some of this others?
You know what? I don't even necessarily think sometimes it's a cover over. I do think that there, you know, it's not as if I look for darkness everywhere. I do think that there are happy, you know, people out there. And I'm determined I'm going to meet some by the time I die.
Still looking. Well, I, and again, just to belabor this, a couple of more points. Helen, you know, thinks about her mother and as I say, observes her so carefully and talks about the insanity train and the DNA and mm-hmm. sort of, especially I think when mothers and daughters are so close, thinking, that's going to be me. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm going to inherit all these traits, all these you know, personality styles that I see in my mother, and perhaps I even look like her. As I get older, I look more and more like her.
Mm-hmm.
But kind of feeling that DNA at work
right.
within one's own self.
Right.
Did you feel that? I mean, is that part of what you wanted to get to in the novel?
I think so, and I also think part of what is going on in the novel, which I think can get a little overshadowed by, say, Claire's unpleasantness or the dynamic of, you know, the fact that Helen really needs to figure out what she's going to do over the next 24 hours.
After she kills her mother.
After she... little detail.
I mean, just to make sure if people
small,
are just joining
small
us,
little detail.
How that fits in.
But is the idea that, you know, within the things that are negative that can be passed down are also these kind of fascinating... you know, quirks of personality that show up. I mean, there's a moment where she's wondering who in the next generations might have inherited right. the mother's mental imbalance. Could it be her slightly arty, oddball daughter? Could it be little Leo, her infant grandchild? Or is it going to be that obvious of a choice? Will it be the arty child? Could it be perhaps her seemingly more stable mm-hmm. child, Emily? And I think that's the thing, is that you do look, and every parent looks at their children and wonders about, are they going to inherit the positive or negative traits? And the thing that's really kind of interesting sometimes is when the child who you think is going to be the negative inheritor ends up taking perhaps that negative thing and twisting it into right. something kind of miraculous and positive, you know, and that's just a freakish, you know, act of God. So that's the exciting part about watching weird DNA flow mm-hmm. through, you know. So I think it's both sides, mm-hmm. I think.
But I wonder if it's more than just a freakish act of God, because I do think that some kids...
Well, there's will and determination.
Well, I was going to say, there's will and... I mean, some kids read the situation, and at some time in their life they say, I'm not going to do that anymore.
Right.
I've seen that. You know, I've seen people do that.
Yeah, and, okay, yes, definitely. You're completely right, which is there's the you know, desire on the part of the individual, and also there's the fact that as time goes by and, you know, we do talk more about things and have a better education, mm-hmm. and there's less of the hiding. I mean, the other thing about one of the things in this book is there's this desire on the part of Helen's family to hide the fact that the mother has a problem. And so part of what the book addresses is the idea of that, the toxic nature of that, that mm-hmm. keeping up appearances and keeping all pain inside the household in a family actually eats in on the family, as opposed to trying to get help or share, you know, what's wrong inside a family outside that house. So yes, I think you're right, which is that there are many influences that mean that generations down the line, the bad thing won't end up you know, being the bad thing.
Yeah. Let me just quickly reintroduce you. That's Alice Siebold, our guest today on Radio Times. She wrote a memoir called Lucky. She also wrote a novel a couple of years ago called The Lovely Bones that's actually being made into a movie, and she's got a new novel out called The Almost Moon. And it is about a family. It's about a daughter, Helen Knightley. She's the divorced mother of two grown children. She's been taking care of her mother, a woman named Claire, and she kills her. And then... I don't know how else to say that. I'm sorry. And then the rest.
How you say it.
And then the rest of the story is really about the next 24, 36 hours as she thinks about her childhood. She thinks about her parents, certainly her mother, and does a couple of specific things as she tries to figure out the enormity of what she's done. Lines open at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. It was interesting to read the reviews of this book and how the reviewers looked at your main character, Helen Knightley, and the struggle that a lot of reviewers had about, should I like her? Is she likable? Do I sympathize with her? And I wonder, with a sort of an enigmatic narrator, whether that matters to you, whether you wanted her to be a complex person and not be heroic so much, but as someone who did something without thinking about it.
I definitely wanted her to be a complex person, and someone who is, as most people are by the time they're 49 years old, difficult. So that was important to me, and you know, I ultimately would hope that readers could find her sympathetic, if mm-hmm. not her action. And that's the difficulty, and that's where it's interesting to me, is she does step over a line, but it's a line that you might just be on the other side of, and mm-hmm. you watch her take that. You know, it's as if she does the killing for you, and you get to see, well, what happens if you do that. And it's, you know, it's a weird question in your own mind, and you get to safely sit on the moral high ground and think, well, you know what? I would never kill my mother or my father.
But let's see what Helen thinks about. And, I mean, I don't think this is giving too much away. I don't think we come to some great aha, if you know what I mean, to say, oh, there's the reason that she did this.
Right. I don't think that I would want to provide a clear explanation. I would want a reader to read the book and come to some understanding of why they would believe it happened. You know, I don't think the writer's role is to put up a prop character that everybody mm-hmm. should love and then explain why they did what they did in a book.
So. I was thinking about The Lovely Bones, where the main character, a teenage girl, is a narrator. She's the victim of a horrible crime.
Right.
And in this case, we've got a 49-year-old difficult woman, as you say, who's the perpetrator of a crime.
Right.
Were you trying to look at something from two different angles?
I wasn't really. The crimes are so different, as are the characters, as are the, you know, perpetrators. I mean, the word perpetrator becomes such a strange term when you apply it to The Almost Moon, I think.
Yeah. I mean, because, again, it's so clinical in a way.
It's very clinical, and it also separates the two, it groups Mr. Harvey and Helen in this very, in one column together. And that's interesting, because then it's only by the definition of legal murder.
Right.
And that's just an interesting territory to explore, I think.
Would you be comfortable if readers came away from this thinking, maybe it's not so bad to do something like this?
I think I'm kind of comfortable with whatever readers come away mm-hmm. with in that way. I think it, you know, the novel poses a question. It's not written to answer one. Right. Yeah.
Let me get some callers in our conversation. And lines open at 1-888-477-9499. We've got Lisa from Newark, Delaware. Hi, Lisa. Go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I absolutely loved your book, Lovely Bones, and one of the most moving parts of the book had to do with when, I believe it was Francis, the spirit that is with the girl who was killed, says to her, it's not until the dead are done with the living that the living can move on. And that's obviously a paraphrase, but that was a real light bulb in my brain kind of moment when I read that. And I was curious if that theme somewhat plays out in this book as well, with Helen and her mother dying, you know, maybe at her own hand, but that her mother, the spirituality or kind of mystic nature that continues between the dead and the living plays out, you know, in this one as well.
Sure. It's an interesting question, Lisa. Thanks for the call. Go ahead, Alice.
I think what I'd say about this book is it is, for good and for bad, struggling with characters that are extremely earthbound. And, you know, if they're going to have a transcendence, they have not found it yet.
Lisa, thanks for the call. We've got Jane from Reading joining us this morning on Radio Times. Hi, Jane. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Yes, good morning.
Good morning.
My point is, this is the age where we keep striving and pushing to forward our mortality as far away as possible, and we are being upset that we have parents we're stuck with that we have to care for. I mean, what's going to happen when we are going to be at that age and our children have to care for us?
And you're talking about your own life, Jane, and the kind of responsibilities you
have? No, my mother died 35 years ago.
Okay.
I would be very happy to have her around, and
gotcha.
I would do anything to have her around and have her and prolong her life. But, yes, I have three daughters and a son, and we have, they're already making jokes who's going to get stuck with mother and keep her in a good way. They're fighting over who's going to have me. But, you know, it's, but then I have a friend who has two sons and they're fighting who's going to be the first one to put her in the home.
Well, and I mean, I think what you're raising is something that many and perhaps even all families are struggling with as people live longer and you've got generations taking care of generations. And Alice Ebold, your thoughts about Jane's comments?
I think, you know, the truth is, first of all, I think it's wonderful that your children are fighting over who gets to take care of you. That probably means that you have four children who have a natural caretaking gene. And perhaps your friend who has two sons who are talking about who's the first to put her in a home don't have that caretaking gene. I think what's very important is if your children do not have the caretaking gene, they need to try to get some help to do the caretaking, because otherwise, you know, it's not just a natural thing that somebody who is a child is also a natural caretaker, and that can be very bad for the older person in that situation too. You know, I guess that's just my general social comment on
that.
Yeah,
Jane, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Do you feel like you have that caretaking gene?
I have it to a certain extent, and I also will, you know, do what I can to make sure that, you know, when I watched my mom, you know, when the hospice worker, I mean, first of all, hospice workers are like, you know, these little angels from heaven.
Indeed they are.
When they come in and you're kind of, talk about DNA, you're kind of like, wow, look at that person. Because they really are able just to give pure compassion to the dying. And I think one of the reasons why they are able to do that is because they have no other emotional attachment to the person who is dying. They have no freight of history. There's no complex relationship there. So, for instance, that kind of thing for my grandmother was a godsend, and it was a godsend for my mother.
Sure.
So, you know, the idea that you should do it all or you suck as a kid, I think, is just putting an unrealistic burden on a child.
Jane, thanks for the call to Radio Times. You can call us as well. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Alice Sebold is our guest today on Radio Times. Her first novel, The Lovely Bones, was a bestseller, and she's got a new novel just out, and it's called The Almost Moon. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
When the artist John Sloan came to New York, he embraced city life as his subject, A member of the Ashcan School, Sloan created realistic images that helped define New York City in the popular imagination. The Delaware Art Museum now presents Seeing the City, Sloan's New York, an exhibition of Sloan's paintings, drawings, and photographs, October 20th through January 20th, sponsored by J.P. Morgan Chase Foundation. Details at delart.org. The Delaware Art Museum supports WHYY.
This is the next to last chance during Radio Times today to make a pledge of support to 91 FM WHYY. Lines are open at 1-888-345-9499. It's an abbreviated membership drive, and we are taking very short breaks in Radio Times during this drive. That's why it's so important that you make that call right now at 1-888-345-9499 and meet the Independence Foundation Challenge, looking for 800 listeners this week from Radio Times. Thank you very, very much.
Support for WHYY is provided by Rutgers Camden, celebrating the 20th anniversary of its nationally accredited Master of Public Policy and Administration program. On Thursday, October 18th, Rutgers Camden will host the Richard C. Goodwin Lecture in honor of Ethel Lawrence, titled Saving Our Cities, Imperative or Impossibility. Details for the Goodwin Lecture on Thursday, October 18th are available online at camden.rutgers.edu.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane, and if you're just joining us, writer Alice Siebold is our guest. She wrote a memoir called Lucky. Her first novel, The Lovely Bones, was published a couple of years ago, and it's going to be made into a movie directed by Peter Jackson. She's got a new novel out, and it's called The Almost Moon, and much has been made of the first sentence. I'll just read it to you. When all is said and done, killing my mother came easily. And it's the story of Helen Knightley. She's a divorced mother of two grown children, and she's been taking care of her difficult mother, a woman named Claire. And it's about a whole host of things, including some of the impulses that daughters have when thinking about their mothers, about the relationship between mothers and daughters, and also how things like dementia and dysfunction can play out within a family. And Alice Siebold grew up here in the Philadelphia suburbs and is our guest today on Radio Times. 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. You're probably going to get asked this question a lot. Has your mother read this book?
Yes, she has.
And her reaction?
My mom is a reader first. That's where I got my love of books. And the first thing she said is, some people are going to need to replace the fictional characters with real people. I'm not one of those people. Mm-hmm. It's a great book.
So she got it. I mean, I would say if I were a mother, if I were your mother, Alice Siebold, and I read this, I would think, oh, is she trying to tell me something? But obviously you have a relationship with this woman.
Yeah, I think we've talked it all out. Right. We're very verbal in our family.
And how about your father?
My father's also read it, and he also had lovely things to say about it. There, you know, like I say, my love of books and literature came from my parents. So for them to actually have a child who is a writer and who is published, that's wonderful for them. You know, they really thrill at my success.
And did they encourage you to be a writer, or they just had lots of books in the house? I mean, it was a family where people read and talked about things?
They had lots of books in the house. I had difficulty reading when I was growing up. I had a slight case of dyslexia, so I was slow to the gate in terms of reading. But I started by writing poetry, and they were big supporters of that, even when I got, you know, in trouble at school because, of course, I was using obscene language in my poems.
And, of course.
Exactly. But you know, and they've been very supportive in that way.
Yeah. I was intrigued that this character, the narrator in the novel, Helen Knightley, works as an artist model, and her mother had worked as a lingerie model.
Right.
And I thought, what an interesting job to have for two characters. Have you ever been an artist model yourself?
No, I got asked quite a few times, and I have to say, I'm so happy I always said no.
And why did you say no?
I always said no because I was too physically self-conscious. It had nothing to do, you know, and then later I would regret. Actually, one of the people who asked me when I was very young later became an extremely successful and well-shown artist. And when I, you know, I thought like, wow, you know, I would be up on the walls of for instance, the Philadelphia Museum of Art.
Oh, interesting.
However, when I saw his work, I was like, wow, I'm glad I said no. because the way in which he used women for me to actually have been a figure in those paintings would have been so upsetting, because you don't have any control over it ultimately.
Of course.
So I'm ultimately happy I did say no.
But I would say Helen and her mother Claire, they're not embarrassed by their bodies.
No, they're not. So that's why it's fiction. You can live your
novelists
fantasies.
Novelists get to do that.
Yes, exactly.
And did you enjoy that fantasy?
Well, it's also Helen has the Claire is only a lingerie model for a series of days, but Helen has the longer career as the artist model. She has a very difficult relationship with that, and there is something psychological to the revelation of the body.
Let me get some callers back in on the conversation. Just a couple open lines at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Talking with Alice Siebold today on the show, and she's got a new novel called The Almost Moon. We've got Ruby from Pittman, New Jersey joining us. Hi, Ruby. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Yes. Good morning.
Good morning.
I am the daughter and only child of a very difficult mother who made lifelong difficult decisions, and of course, as a minor, I was drug along in her life. Now I am 5 years into caring for her in advanced dementia. I am not happy. I am not happy at this point. I feel kind of crazy at this point, and I, without reading your book, which I am going to get, I can truly, and I hope you don't take this the wrong way, I have no plans to do this, but I can understand now when I hear that a child killed a parent. I honestly can understand how a person has been pushed to that edge. I can.
Well,
as awful as it sounds,
of course,
I can understand.
Of course, and we're talking about people thinking and feeling, not acting. But let me get Alice Siebold just to respond to that. And I wonder, I know you're at the beginning of your book tour, whether you're going to hear these stories as you talk about your book.
I would say I think I will. I would just also thank you for calling and saying that, because I think it's a brave thing to say, and I think it's hard to say, but as Marty says, you're talking about thinking about it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the difference is, I think that this idea that thought is forbidden is the wrong idea, because we really have to allow our minds and our imaginations to be free, so that in the real world we do the right thing, mm-hmm. and we're allowed to stay in control of ourselves when we need to be in control of ourselves. But, if you're alone in that, it's an incredibly burdensome situation to be in. I hope you have a friend or, somebody you can just call and scream as loud as possible in their ear, first saying to hold the phone away. But I think it's very smart and brave that you recognize that you are in that very frustrating place.
And just to underscore what Alice Siebold said, Ruby, I think we both hope that you do have someone you can talk to about this, especially as an only child. And I got the feeling the way you were describing your mother over the years, there's just so much heavy history here. Are you there, Ruby?
Can you hear me?
Yes,
still?
Go ahead, Ruby.
Okay. Yeah, very the anger. I think had it been that I've just had this care in these last 5 years, even though it is difficult. Say, but before that, our lives were what I would call normal, mm-hmm. and I had good memories. But unfortunately, let's just say there isn't any good memories.
Right, and that's what makes it complicated too.
Yeah, but it is bad marriages and boyfriends and dragging the child along in 5 schools a year, no regard for moving and I think that now, because I know that if it was reversed, I was sick and she was well, the most awful thing of the whole thing is I wouldn't see hide nor hair of her.
Mm.
Nothing would have affected her life, her schedule. I said, if I went, I'm still young, if I went into dementia early, I say somebody would have just found me walking down the street and, you know, had to put me somewhere because it wouldn't have been her. So, but in any case, I'm going to get the book. I think it's important that other people that are listening to the show and are in my situation, and you don't have to be an only child. You can be one of five children, but you're the only one that's going. You're the only one that's doing it.
No, I really, I appreciate.
It's important that people know that when you have those thoughts, that it's not awful. I actually think that it's probably human. You're just being pushed to the brink.
It's very human.
And
I appreciate the Ruby.
I'm going to get your.
Okay.
Get your book,
I appreciate the call to Radio Times.
Thank you.
You're welcome. A difficult topic. And just to pick up on that, to you, Alice Siebold, and you talked earlier in the hour about the kind of, sort of fantasy vision we have of older women. But I also wonder whether this mother-daughter duo has been over-fantasized as well, that the daughters are seen as the giving children, you know, who are there, and but you're raising a whole bunch of different questions about that, or even a little cold water on that idea.
I think it's the expectation. It's the unquestioned, still in 2007, unthinking expectation that the daughter, by and large, will take care of the aging parents, often taking care of the husband's aging parents, even though it's the husband's parents, not the mother's parents. And I guess I'm just throwing that up for grabs of why are we still making that assumption that the woman should be and has to be the caretaker when she's not necessarily a natural-born caretaker. It's not good for the elderly person she's supposedly caretaking either. So if you don't like going at it from the direction of supporting the younger person in that coupling, then support the older version or person in that coupling. It's just an, you know, from Mary Cassatt onwards, we've perhaps really idealized that idea of the mother-daughter relationship. It doesn't always work so beautifully.
Mm. That's Alice Siebold, our guest today on Radio Times. Tell us about how you work as a writer, and I'm curious about that, only because I think every writer has their own way of doing it. Some are very disciplined, you know, put their rear end in that chair, and if it's staring at a computer screen, they just sort of have to go to work. And others kind of wander the world and let ideas filter down.
I'm definitely the former, not the latter.
Are you?
I'm very disciplined, and I try to work early in the morning before it's light out.
In the morning?
Four or five in the morning is important to me, and I can work 4 to 6 hours a day in terms of writing. Then there can be some hours of editing, but my brain pretty much fries in terms of creating before that. And I'll keep my schedule, which even can get as early as 3 a.m. in the morning, which is somewhat inhuman. I'll keep that for about 6 to 8 weeks, and then I'll take a 6 to 8 week period where I'm getting up at a slightly more sane time, like 6 a.m. or 7 a.m., just because I also want to have a, you know, somewhat of an existence with other human beings.
Right. Well, you have a husband, right?
Yes, yes. Right. Occasionally I like to see him. I mean, he's also a writer, and we have opposite. He'll often be going to bed at 3, and I'm waking up at 3, and we just kind of wave hello.
And you like it because it's dark early in the morning?
Yeah.
And it feels, oftentimes at 3 in the morning, it feels like you're the only person who's awake in the whole world.
Yeah, I love that whole, kind of getting a jump on the day kind of sense. And getting to my work before anybody else is awake. And, you know, there's that secret under the blanket with a flashlight, being bad, no one knows you're doing it, playing with your army man kind of, you know, sick kid kind of way about it that I love. Yeah.
Comic books under the bed sheets, right?
Yeah, exactly.
And what do you do then? So say you're fried, your writing brain is fried at noon or early afternoon. What do you do the rest of the day?
I usually try to go on a good long walk someplace and, you know, find myself jealous of, those British writers from a couple centuries ago who were always talking about the big, you know, striking out through the fields. And, because it's hard now to go walking without getting kind of interrupted by cars and all sorts of other things. But I do leave my cell phone at home.
Good for you. So, that's discipline.
Yeah, so that kind of thing, and just, you know, hanging out with my animals. So.
And that's Alice Siebold, our guest today on Radio Times, talking about her new book called The Almost Moon. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen, and this is Radio Times.
And thank you, Marty. I am Susan Greenbaum, one of the producers of Radio Times, here with my co-producer, Alan Tu. Devorah Listick's in the control room directing the show. We're hoping that you enjoyed this hour of Radio Times.
That was
it's
a
very
hour.
Interesting conversation,
I really
isn't
like
it?
That.
She stirred up a lot of controversy, I might say, with her new novel. That's Alice Siebold. Hoping you enjoy this program, and in fact, you can show your appreciation for what Marty does day in and day out by becoming a member of WHYY, giving us a call at 1-888-345-9499. Alan, we have a lot of work to do. Not only
do
we have to get ready for tomorrow's show, but we also have to entice, about 100 of you to give us a call in the next couple minutes in order to meet our goal. And we're in the throes of a very interesting situation here. The Independence Foundation has offered to give $10,000 to WHYY if we hear from a total of 800 members during this shortened pledge drive. So we're on our way, but we have goals to meet, and we need to hear from about 100 folks to get us to our goal of hearing from 800 of you by Friday at noon. Again, the Independence Foundation will give WHYY $10,000, which goes a very long way here, if we hear from 800 folks, listeners of Radio Times, between now and midday Friday. So here's the number to call, 1-888-345-9499, or pledging online counts as well, whyy.org.
All right, and yes, you can
definitely
pledge online, whyy.org. Also, when you're there, you know, go over to the Radio Times site, and probably in just a half hour or so, the interview with Alice Siebold will be available to listen to online, streaming there, or as an MP3. So if you didn't hear all of it, you go to WHYY, and you will have a chance to listen to all of it. But do make a pledge if you can. I'm suggesting, say, $50, and we'll give you the new WHYY tote bag, and you'll be going towards helping us make this Independence Foundation challenge. Again, as Susan was saying, by Friday 12 noon, just during Radio Times, we're hoping to hear from 800 of our listeners for Radio Times to pledge their support, and we're about a quarter of their way there, but we want to ramp things up a little bit because we're in day 4 of 7, so wait, no, just kidding, we're in day 5
Yikes.
Of 7,
okay.
So you can see the picture.
1-888-345-9499, whyy.org. If you're a regular listener to Radio Times, you know that day in and day out, Marty covers topics of broad interest, but topics that are important for all of us, a community of learners, in a way. Speaking of a community, we're trying something new this year that we're kind of looking forward to, and
that
is we're taking Radio Times on the road.
We are.
And if you are a member of WHYY and we're coming to your area, we will send you an invitation to join us one evening to watch a live and special broadcast of Radio Times. We're going to Princeton in a few weeks, and we've invited members in the Princeton area, and fortunately, we're filled to capacity from members who've already RSVP'd to the event, but we're coming to your neighborhood soon, maybe. But if
are we going to throw candy out when we drive by? That'd
I don't know, fun. But you can only watch it and come participate if you're a member of WHYY, which